throw on your battle vest and open this pit up, because today we are going to thrash our way through the music of Metallica. Joining me are Associate Professor of Philosophy at the College of William and Mary, Chris Fryman.
Thanks for having me.
And Distinguished Service Professor of Philosophy at King's College, editor of the Blackwell Philosophy and Pop Culture series, and author of the new book, The Meaning of Metallica, Ride the Lyrics, Bill Irwin. Bill, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Landry. Good to be here.
If I may, Bill, especially because we actually had emailed you over a year ago at this point, probably 18 months ago, just being like, we'd love to get you on the show. We love your Blackwell Philosophy and Pop Culture series. And you said, well, I've got this book that I'm working on about Metallica. And we were like, Metallica, that's, you know, and it just, we never got around to it. But then I was like, you know what? The book is coming out. Stranger Things brings it back into the zeitgeist all of a sudden. They just used Enter Sandman on, I think, Westworld a week ago or so. So why not do it now? It's a great time to talk about what Metallica can mean for us today and what we can learn from the lyrics. But I was curious, why Metallica of all things for this book? Because you seem like a guy who, based on your writings, is, you know, very well acquainted with not just Metallica, but a lot of music and a lot of media and literature. So why Metallica of all things?
Well, Metallica has been the soundtrack of my life since about 1984 when Ride the Lightning came out. And they've been therapy to me. They've been poetry. They've been philosophy. They've taken me through a teenage existential crisis. They've taken me through my midlife crisis. And you know what? I started writing about Metallica just in connection with this book, Educated by Tara Westover. She was raised as sort of a fundamentalist Mormon. And I was quoting from Metallica because there are songs about religion. And James Hetfield was raised, James Hetfield, the lead singer and chief lyricist, was raised as a Christian Scientist. And it just sort of took on a life of its own, the book. And the lyrics have just always meant so much to me personally that I just sort of had to do it as a labor of love. And hopefully the book is a conversation starter on the lyrics, certainly not a conversation ender.
And Chris, knowing from your various Facebook posts, they're no Limp Bizkit, who I know is your favorite, but does Metallica mean anything special to you? Or is it emblematic of the genre? How did you come to appreciate them?
Well, I was going to say, maybe we need to do a new episode on Limp Bizkit at some point. So put me down for that.
I'll put it in the queue. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. We'll have to go 2 hours, special edition. So I mean, my experience, I think, was somewhat similar. Although that's really interesting. I didn't know that about James Hetfield being raised a Christian Scientist. That's interesting. But just, you know, in terms of my own experience, I'm trying to remember what some mid-90s, at some point in the mid-90s, I'm old enough to have been a part of the generation that listened to music on cassette tapes. And I remember, it is funny, we've gone from cassette tapes to now purely digital within my lifetime. That's how far we've come. But I want to say 4 cassette tapes at a certain stage of my life when I was really getting into metal. And 2 of them were Metallica. I believe Ride the Lightning and Master of Puppets. And so I would just, you know, as a kid does, just play it endlessly on repeat. And yeah, I like the band. They've, you know, they've reinvented themselves multiple times. I pretty much like all the things that they do. I like, you know, I like that they don't seem to be too deterred by the critics. Like they just kind of do their own thing, and they make the music that they want to make, and they make people happy. And, you know, I've been listening to them for over 20 years now. I expect that I'll continue to be listening to them for as long as I'm listening to music. So yeah, Metallica and libertarianism, what's not to like?
Well, that's really the interesting thing is I was thinking about this and I was like, I mean, you could obviously do whole podcasts on Metallica. I'm sure they exist out there. But if there's one person who is going to be able to tie it into the things we usually talk about on this show, I know it was going to be you two. So what is emblematic about Metallica? Because I think my place in this conversation is very different because I am at best a casual Metallica fan. My dad was very musical. He's a musician. My mother is very musical. They were into rock music and stuff, but they stopped just short of things that got that heavy. Like I was emailing Bill. I was like, when it got to, you know, heavy things, my dad raised me in a Rush household rather than a Metallica household, which, you know, you get into the libertarian leaning lyrics there. But it wasn't quite, you know, the thrash of Kill 'Em All or anything like that. What is there for libertarians in Metallica? Because I think there is some aesthetic reasons and, you know, that type of genre has a lot of appreciation within the community. But is there something more to it than just the sort of rebellious do-it-yourself aesthetic of heavy metal as a genre? Or does Metallica specifically do something special?
Well, you mentioned Rush there, Landry. So let me pick up on that because I'm sure a lot of listeners to the podcast are Rush fans, very popular band in the libertarian community. And there are some connections there with Rush. The members of Metallica are all Rush fans. And in fact, they wanted Geddy Lee to be the producer of Master of Puppets, which is, of course, enjoying a renaissance at the time. And it almost happened. There was they just couldn't get the timing right. And the song structure is actually, people who are only familiar with the sort of simpler Metallica songs like Enter Sandman may not see this, but with a song like Master of Puppets coming into prominence again, the song structure is pretty complicated. It's not perhaps at the level of what you see in a lot of Rush songs, but once you get in from Master of Puppets and into Injustice for All, that's where they really went very far in the direction of progressive metal. And I think lyrically, people who find libertarian leanings in Rush, which are certainly there purposely so. I mean, Neil Peart, in particular, a fan of Ayn Rand and Anthem and the Fountainhead, very much that aesthetic and that credo of doing things on our own terms. We're artists and we're making this art, and as Chris had said in the introduction, in some ways, not even caring very much about certainly what the critics say, and to some extent, not even what the fans would say. And I think ultimately, what's there that ties Rush and Metallica, and that has some libertarian appeal, aside from, as we'll get into, I'm sure, issues that are specifically those of liberty and justice. And anti-war. But aside from that, there's just a tremendous individualism and a sense of individual responsibility and taking responsibility for one's own life and creating art that is authentic and genuinely reflects that.
Yeah, I have to say I'm loving all of these little interesting bits of information. I had no idea about the Geddy Lee connection. That's really cool. Yeah, and for me, I wouldn't even say it's so much the lyrics, but more, I don't know, ethos or something like that, for lack of a better term. So I don't know. So Bill, you might be able to correct me if I'm wrong here, but I remember reading something about how at one point, I guess in the 90s, Metallica heard a Soundgarden record and they loved it, and they said, "All right, and now we're making Load." Which was not a critically acclaimed album because it was, you know, it sounded like a little bit, you know, grungy, like Soundgarden. And, you know, they got a lot of negative feedback on it, but they did it because that's what they wanted to do. And then they did Reload, which was a similar sort of sound. And I just always kind of respected that ethos or that vibe where they said, this is the music that we like. This is the music that we want to make. And, you know, if you like it, buy it. If you don't. But we're going to do things our way. And to me, that's always something that I've really respected, and it's resonated with me.
No, that's right. That they've always done what they wanted to do. And the Load albums were really disappointing to a lot of long-term fans, but myself included at the time. I've since come to really appreciate them because metal itself was falling on hard times at that point. Little did I know, almost double metaphor of underground death metal was really taking off, as was the new wave of black metal. But I wasn't in touch with that. But anything that was at all mainstream metal was basically pushed aside. And we were hoping that Metallica was going to carry the flag for metal forward. And we got something that really sounded a bit, perhaps too much of the time with the alternative and grunge scene. But hell, that's what they wanted to do, and they did it. And there's even a country song, Mama Said, on Load. And hats off for them for doing whatever the hell they wanted. And they definitely didn't care what the critics said. It's never been about trying to please Rolling Stone or the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame or any of those bullshit institutions. I think it did sting when some fans had some negative reaction at various points. But even that, they've done what they've wanted to do. And certainly there's something admirable about that with the libertarian ethos, as Chris was saying.
I liked that country song. The album definitely grew on me too. At first, I was like, I don't know about this. And then, you know, over time, I started to like, and I listen to it now. The other nice thing too is my 8-year-old son, I'm getting him into it. And so he's more of like the Load Reload era, but it's given me a renewed appreciation for that part of Metallica's timeline.
Yeah, and Mama Said is a great song, and it actually is directly inspired by his own mother's death. She died when he was 16 years old because they were Christian Scientists, essentially, and she didn't take medical treatment for cancer. And his father, who was a Christian Scientist, had left the family. And so he was, in a sense, orphaned. His father wasn't dead, but he had to go live with an older brother. And you really start to get on those Load and Reload albums some very personal reflections that are coming in a way that you didn't get quite as much early on.
So just for my own curiosity, Bill, do you know why he left Christian Science? I assume that he did. Do you know why? What prompted that?
Oh, well, I think after his mother died and he moved in with his brother, he didn't darken the doors of any kind of church for a very long time. I mean, he had had enough of religion, right? And there's lots of anti-religious animus and songs, particularly on the early albums, right? Creeping Death is the retelling of the Exodus story, the flight out of Egypt, and Leper Messiah really taking aim at the televangelists. And the song that's particularly about the Christian Scientist upbringing is The God That Failed off of the Black Album. So I think he took leave of Christian Scientists' religion just because it had never made any sense to him. He had seen the results of not, you know, taking modern medicine into account. It also limited him in a lot of ways. He had to excuse himself from like health lessons in high school, and I think it kept him from playing high school football because he didn't want to get injured and not, you know, do anything that would be proper for injury, or maybe they wouldn't even let him play if he, I don't know, but it really, it left a bad taste in his mouth.
We've been talking about the sort of do-it-yourself ethos that the band had. Mostly in a stylistic sense, they were the tone of the albums, the production style, the structures of the song, and that is very, very potent and recognizable when you look at the arc of their entire discography. But it's interesting to look at them in sort of discrete periods, and I think, Bill, your book does this specifically because it is about the lyrics more than anything. It's called Meaning of Metallica, Ride the Lyrics, which is where a big part of the message of the band is really carried. There is the aesthetic power of heavy metal, but the stories that they are telling and the real nuance comes from the words that James Hetfield is writing. And there are a lot of changes in the way that they're tackling their subjects, from the, you know, classic early thrash teenage rebellion of Kill 'Em All, and then you're getting sort of institutional attacks in And Justice for All and stuff like that. And then you're moving on to a lot more sort of, it's like a really nuanced kind of interpersonal conflict in some of the later albums as well. What do you make of the sort of almost flat out aggression and sort of attacking of institutions that goes on in the tone of the lyrics versus the sort of live and let live, almost born out of this hippie ethos of the sort of post Vietnam era? Like, how do those two things intersect? And it's a really interesting dynamic to me that they have, you know, become this older band. Have they just mellowed with age over time? Or is there something more to that?
Oh, I mean, it's a great question, Landry. And I think those things fit together very well, right? And in the sense of the live and let live sort of hippie mentality, the band was headquartered in San Francisco, still is, although James Hetfield couldn't tolerate living there anymore. He's moved to Colorado. But, you know, the atmosphere of being a San Francisco band and the sort of live and let live and, you know, try anything and let your freak flag fly sort of mentality of San Francisco certainly is part of that. But of course, part of the hippie mentality too was always questioning institutions. And so questioning and really brutalizing religious institutions and questioning government institutions, that all sort of fits with a hippie mentality, but it also is not done to the sounds of you know, Pete Seeger jangling guitar or Kumbaya. You know, it's put forward in a very different way. And there's also a very prominent anti-war message in particularly early Metallica songs like Fight Fire with Fire and For Whom the Bell Tolls and then Disposable Heroes. But listening to those songs, if you're not listening to the lyrics, all you get is aggression. But these are anti-war songs that are not, you know, kind of wimpy and whiny, give peace a chance kind of things. They're, you know, grab you by the lapels and say stop the madness anti-war songs. So, I mean, I think it all fits together. And I think over the course of time, you see Hetfield's lyrics develop from the sort of mission statement on Kill 'Em All of let's spread this gospel of heavy metal. Ride the Lightning is a death-obsessed album. Almost every song on there deals with death, most explicitly For Whom the Bell Tolls and Fade to Black, which is a suicide song, and Creeping Death and Trapped Under Ice about cryonics. And that really spoke to my budding existentialist philosopher as a teenager. And then you get into Master of Puppets, where nearly every song deals with manipulation, whether it's the title track, which really is if you look closely at the lyrics, a song about the self-manipulation that occurs under addiction, although it can be interpreted allegorically in other contexts as well. But you have the manipulation of religion in Leper Messiah and the manipulation of an institution in Welcome Home Sanitarium. And then, as you mentioned before, and as we were discussing with Chris, you get to more self-reflective and personal-sounding songs when you get to the Black Album and the Load albums and beyond.
I should say also, one thing I appreciate about a lot of Metallica's lyrics is that they seem to strike a nice balance between, or maybe a middle ground between, you know, bands that have lyrics that are just completely meaningless or nonsensical, and then bands that are just way over the top preachy, like, you know, you listen to a Rage Against the Machine song and they're lecturing at you. And I don't want to be lectured in my heavy metal. But I think Metallica did a nice job of kind of finding a middle ground there, where they were subtle, more subtle than a band like Rage Against the Machine's lyrics, but they were also meaningful. And that's what I like. I think that's kind of the right way to do it.
Never sanctimonious. I mean, growing up in the 80s, I mean, There was the metal crowd, and you know, I was taking classes with the kids who were going to college, but none of them were listening to Metallica. They were all listening to U2, and I could never stand U2. I found them sanctimonious and preachy, and I don't know if you ever heard the joke, what's the difference between God and Bono, right? God doesn't walk around Dublin thinking that he's Bono. That was sort of, you know, I just couldn't stand that. And I think Chris is just exactly right that Metallica, and it's partly because there's no agreed political point of view within the band. It happens to be that Hetfield writes the lyrics, but they're never so on point to a particular moment or particular current political issue that it seems preachy or it seems anything like that. So when you get to the most overtly political album, Injustice for All, those songs really, they could be speaking of an earlier time, right? Like Short as Straw, which really speaks in some ways to the Red Scare of the 1950s, but is perennial, right? It fit the mood of the 80s, and it doesn't go away. It seems to fit the cancel culture of today, but it's never about a particular politician or a particular issue so specifically that you feel like you're being preached at.
I'm always curious about what libertarians think about a certain topic, because I find it more divisive than it might seem at times, which is something Metallica is very, very known for today, at least, which is the issue of intellectual property. So if our fans are not familiar, Metallica was involved heavily and was really critical in the and driving the shutdown of file sharing site Napster, which was really kind of the canary in the coal mine for what the sort of music industry was turning into with digitization, and which sort of leans into streaming and how people consume the media that they're listening to. So I'm curious specifically from perhaps you two. You too. That was a good pun. bringing it back. What do you make of Metallica's sort of stance on intellectual property? Do you find it justified, or do you think that was a misstep, or is there some nuance? And also, do you see any evidence of what you might think in their lyrics and how they've done things? Because that's one thing that I didn't immediately pick up on when I was trying to search for lyrics that had a lot of themes. But that doesn't mean that it's not necessarily there.
I don't know. Maybe I might be the only libertarian who's sort of agnostic about intellectual property. Like, I know both sides are really, they're really, you know, they dig in their heels on these things. I confess, I'm not really sure what I think about intellectual property. I can see the merits of both sides of that argument. And, you know, I think there's probably a place for it, but I also think it definitely does get abused. And so what exactly an intellectual property regime should look like, ideally, I'm not really sure. That being said, though, I did respect Metallica's position. So whether or not they were right or wrong about Napster, I think they had a point. And the point, as I see it, is, look, like, we're producing this work. You're enjoying it. You're getting this benefit, and so it's appropriate to pay us. Like, I respect that. You know, if you provide a valuable service for someone, it doesn't seem to me outlandish to ask them to pay you for it. I think a lot of people they didn't like it. I remember Metallica's popularity really took a hit, and I also have this memory. I don't know what it was. It was like the Grammys or something like that, where they had the Napster guy like present something, and then they cut to Metallica and they were like making a joke about Metallica, and they kind of sunk into their seats because they were embarrassed because everybody was kind of hating on them for their Napster stance. But I think whether or not Napster was a good thing or a bad thing, or whether the intellectual property regime that we have is good or bad, I respect the stance that I remember this quote from Lars, actually. He says something, he's like, "We're not toothpaste." He's like, yeah, like, I, he's like, we are people who are making something, And like, we ought to, like, we're not like, this is me, you know, putting way too much philosophical window dressing on it, but it's like, don't treat us as mere means. You know, we're doing something for you. So it's only fair that you do a little something for us. And so I thought that they got a disproportionate amount of hate for their Napster stance.
Yeah, I largely agree with Chris. I'm largely agnostic on intellectual property. I think it is property, but I think what counts as property itself needs to spontaneously develop and evolve. It has over time, and intellectual property, because it's so technology-based, has to spontaneously develop and evolve, and will spontaneously evolve, and has spontaneously developed and evolved, you know, more than other things. I mean, I remember very strict prohibitions on what you could photocopy at a certain point, right? And that's loosened up quite a lot, right? Now, there's some inside baseball and irony when it comes to Metallica, right? Because they made their breakthrough because of underground tape trading, right? There was their famous demo, No Life to Leather, that spread around the world by one person taping it and passing it to another, and they encouraged that. Back in the 80s, I mean, I go back even further than Chris, before cassettes were the old LPs. They've, for some reason, enjoyed a renaissance. People like listening to vinyl again. It is richer, but I hated the skips and the hisses and all that. But, you know, sometimes I got my very first taste of Metallica by making a tape of Ride the Lightning from my friend's record. And then I bought it, and then I've bought everything and, you know, multiple media since. But that was, you know, technically a violation at some point, but Metallica had no problem with that. They also, at various points, encouraged bootlegging of their concerts and sharing that, almost all of the Grateful Dead. So, you know, they've been sort of loose on that in some ways. So what you didn't get from Metallica, and you couldn't really expect, was a tight philosophical argument about what intellectual property is and why you're violating it. And what really bothered them most, if you take a look at the interviews, is just the scale that it was going on with Napster. It wasn't one buddy making a tape for another, that kind of thing, but it was just spreading the music without any kind of recompense, right? So, I mean, that was the real problem. Also part of the real problem is that the main mouthpiece on the issue for the band was Lars Ulrich, who tends to be, you know, sometimes a bit of a jackass and way outspoken and that kind of thing. So that's unfortunate. I think from a public relations standpoint, they didn't handle it well. But I think they ultimately did the music business a service by making that stance. And what we have now is certainly not as good as it was for artists in the 80s or 90s in terms of generating revenue and royalties. But at least it's something with the streaming services. And I think we've sort of spontaneously evolved where, you know, people are willing to pay for a subscription service or however they stream their music. And so artists get something, even if it's not as much as they wanted.
And I will say too, I'm sensitive to the ways in which intellectual property, you know, can inhibit creativity. This discussion made me think of the infamous, I don't know if either of you have seen this, Vanilla Ice interview. Does this ring a bell? Where he's trying to convince the listeners that he didn't sample, it's like a Queen song or something like that.
Yeah, yeah. Under pressure.
Right. And he's like trying to convince the, he's like, it's a ding. It's not a ding. Like,
right.
So I don't have to pay any royalties here. It's like, I don't know about that. And so, you know, I can definitely see how overly zealous, you know, IP rules can inhibit creativity too.
And one thing I'll say also, and this is just a small tidbit in Metallica's defense, technically, from the intellectual standpoint, the letter of the law, I had to ask them for permission to quote their lyrics. And some artists refuse, some charge. Poets are notorious for this, charging money or outright refusing permission for you to quote from their poem. But they didn't charge me a dime to quote their lyrics. So, you know, it's not like they would have made a fortune off of me and my little book, but, you know, that is at least principle that they recognize that, come on, that's a bullshit thing. I mean, it pretty much is a bullshit thing, I think, that I should have to ask to quote lyrics. And I think that's something where you see intellectual property law evolve, where that's going to drop by the wayside completely at some point. But for now, I had to ask, and at least they recognize that this is, you know, the guy shouldn't even have to ask.
I'm amused to hear that poets are particularly ruthless.
Yeah.
It just seems contrary to the spirit of poetry. I don't know.
They are notoriously so. Sometimes even in their wills for the estate, there will be no granting of quotation from their poetry. I guess some of it has to do with poems being ordinarily very short units. And so to quote the whole poem, you know, I don't know, could potentially take away from sales or the original context in which the poem was in a larger work of poetry. Also, lots of poets are just assholes, I guess, you know, who...
They're not getting paid much, so they're trying to hold on to whatever they're getting, probably, is the case.
Yeah, but it also, though, I mean, the usual request for the quotation is in a work of criticism, right? So somebody who wants to write a work on them, and it's not going to be completely flattering, and they want to, you know, limit the way in which they're discussed. I mean, it's dumb, but they do it. Not all poets, sir, but notoriously some.
Right. And if you have a fair use justification for the criticism, it's still on you to prove that if they were to bring a suit against you. So it's really just an opportunity for them to try and you know, extract as much revenue as they can in via whatever means, most likely.
No, that's right. And fair use is really the operative term there. And it's a vague term, and it's meant to change and to evolve. And you know, I find that to be a very libertarian kind of notion, the spontaneity and the open-endedness of the development.
We mentioned before the sort of lack of a tight argument or philosophy that Metallica represents, and how Chris was like, I don't want to get preached at when I'm listening to, you know, my heavy metal, and, you know, that the group is really about sort of loose principles and ideas rather than nuanced, very tightly specific, like even like policy positions or, you know, planks in a platform that they're trying to support. You both talk about how that's something that you kind of enjoy about the band. Is that something that you like about music in general as compared to other media? Because I feel like when you watch a TV show or a movie, it's much easier to come away with saying, like, this is what the point of this piece of media was. There was a sequence of events and framing. And you can do that with songs, and there are songs that are very much trying to tell a story with a point. But I feel like in general, there's a bit more of an impressionistic, thematic sense to music. And do you like that about heavy metal, or are there any other examples of groups that you think do have that really, really surgical way of writing lyrics that you think might do it differently than Metallica?
Yeah, so I mean, I typically listen to music to feel rather than to think. So I definitely know people, they're super into lyrics, and they like to, you know, dissect the lyrics and think about them. I like music that just makes me feel a certain way. And, you know, I confess, I like a lot of, you know, really heavy bands, like deathcore bands. And unless you look up the lyrics... And I have years of experience trying to understand the words, and I still have trouble without assistance. but I just like it because it makes me feel a particular way. And to me, I think that's kind of one of the unique values of music, as opposed to, say, something like a novel or a movie. So, of course, those make you feel a certain way, but they also make you think a certain way. And obviously, that has its place. But oftentimes, you know, I just want to put on the headphones. I want to Blare, Slipknot, or something like that. And you know, it just takes me away for a while. And I, you know, like I said, different strokes for different folks. That, you know, not everybody's going to feel that way about music. I have heard, this is an interesting aside, I feel like this is like kind of flattering to, so I don't know. But I've read things that say the experience that heavy metal listeners get from listening to heavy metal is very similar to the experience that classical music fans get. And it's, I don't know what it is. It's something about like, you just, it's the music. It's not really the lyrics. It's like the way it makes you feel. And so what I take from this is that, you know, Slipknot listeners are, you know, as sophisticated as like Mozart and Beethoven listeners. That makes me feel good. As someone who doesn't really like Mozart, I don't know, never saw the appeal.
Well, it's interesting you bring that up, because I always thought it was odd, and I can see where people got it, but I think it's a stereotype, you know, that metalheads are, you know, dirty, lazy rebels who, you know, don't care about anything, when in reality, a majority of them want to, you know, follow after the people that they're watching on stage, and they devote themselves to highly technical, practiced art forms that are extremely precise in a classical music sense. Like, I have played the guitar for many years, but I, you know, I lapse and stuff like that, but I would not call myself, you know, musical or, you know, very technical in any sense. The people I know who play metal are like, I sit down, I practice, I have exercises, there are techniques that I use. It is much more organized than the reputation and aesthetics of metal might likely be or perceived as by an outsider.
Oh, I say right on with both of you. I mean, I think the commonality between metal and classical, aside from the technical proficiency, is just that really it is art and not merely entertainment, right? Lots of pop music, I mean, with a very loose definition of art, counts as art, but it doesn't aspire to anything higher, right? And to me, metal delivers in a way that classical generally doesn't. Aside from opera, if you count that in the classical genre, you don't usually get lyrics, right? I mean, some Lieder and Schumann Lieder and Schubert Lieder, and I forget who that is. You know, you generally don't get lyrics, right? And so part of what's great with metal done. With Metallica, I'm not going to speak that metal in general, is that you can take it primarily for the feeling, as Chris does, or you can couple that with the lyrics, or you can look at the lyrics separately. And you know, to me, that's similar to the way in which when the Matrix first came out in the late 90s, early 2000s. Plenty of people simply enjoyed it as an action movie, and it's fine to enjoy it as just an action movie, but you can also reflect on it and get much more out of it. And as I suggested from very early on, particularly with the Ride the Lightning album, which is lyrically very well crafted and death-obsessed, it spoke to me as the budding young existentialist and poet. You know, the lyrics are suggestive and they've meant a lot. And, you know, being authored by a real person who himself has changed and developed over time, the music and the lyrics have changed and developed over time, whereas the writers of a film series or a television show may feel an obligation to keep things true to a character or a plot line or storyline or something like that. The individual artist has much more leeway and latitude. And Bob Dylan fans don't appreciate it very much when I make the comparison, but there are comparisons to be made between Hetfield and Bob Dylan for some of the changes and some of the fan reactions over time, and also, quite frankly, for the voice they don't sound alike, but neither of them has anything like a classical singing voice, and both of them have made a virtue out of the sort of, you know, not great voice that they have. And this is what great artists can do.
What do you think the most libertarian song that Metallica has is? And your favorite? I'm just curious about your favorite. I always want to know, and why.
Well, so I'll go first, I suppose. I'll say probably the most libertarian song that they have is Eye of the Beholder off of Injustice for All, which is very much, in some ways, it's a Cliff Notes version of Mills on Liberty. It's talking about freedom of expression. And the value of freedom of expression, even with what you disagree with, or especially with what you disagree with, that energy derives from both the plus and negatives, as the lyrics go. So you know, maybe that's the most libertarian in the sense of really putting forward explicitly the virtue of liberty. There are other songs that are more expressive of individualism. You could talk about Don't Tread on Me, notoriously, as capturing the non-aggression principle or something like that. But, you know, there's plenty to say. But if I had to pick one, particularly one that's not, a well-known song, I'd say Eye of the Beholder, if somebody wants to check that out. And I mean, for a personal favorite, I would just go back to Ride the Lightning, and the song that first spoke to me is Fade to Black, which is basically a suicide song, but one that manages not to catalyze despair, but instead hope. And it had that effect for me as a depressed teenager, and I know it's had that effect for many, many other fans.
Yeah, great questions. I don't know. Here's maybe a bit of a curveball for most libertarian. I might say The Unforgiven, because that's all. It's sort of about the dangers and the harms of being deprived of freedom. I really like the lyrics and the sound of The Unforgiven. So I would recommend that to all libertarians. Favorite? That's a tough one. I mean, I like Creeping Death, in part because it's one of the very few sort of like Passover appropriate heavy metal songs. That's like a very, that's a very short list. Also, I don't know, this is just because this song, this was just one of the songs that I would play all the time in my youth. One, like that's just, it's just awesome. It's just an awesome song. So I would put those two up as some of my favorites.
Thanks for listening. As always, the best way to keep in touch with us and get more Pop and Lock content is to follow us on Twitter. You can find us at the handle @PopandLockPod. That's pop, the letter N, lock with an E, like the philosopher, pod. Make sure to follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. We look forward to unraveling your favorite show or movie next time.